God, I'll tell you something. That's something else. I hope I'll get a hand or two. Maybe Bud will clap for me after I get through talking. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me to speak here tonight. I've always wanted to speak at the Cornhuskers Jamboree, whatever the hell you call this thing. I almost made it. This isn't really it. It starts tomorrow morning. Maybe next year. I used to drink a lot, and I don't have to drink anymore. That's the message, you know. I heard my good friend Cliff R. speak last Saturday night, and he said he came to AA in 1965, and he hadn't found it necessary to have a drink since then. He did drink, but it wasn't necessary. And he got sober in 1970. I came to AA in 1968, and I got sober at the end of 1969, and I haven't had a drink since. And I know quite a few people here, you know. We brought everybody from California is gonna talk, except one or two people, you know. And I'm anxious to hear those one or two people. We've all heard ourselves so many times. And it's good to see my friend Click. I haven't seen him for a while. And I knew him back in Los Angeles. And so I guess that's about it. I can't think of anything else to say except go into my story, which I'm almost apologetic. You know, sometimes you hear such exciting things from these podiums. My God, some of the things some of these guys have done, it just make curl your hair, you know. And you can believe quite a bit of that stuff. You know. Those stories are really exciting, and I love to hear them, you know. And all I ever did is just sat around and drank. I used to watch a lot of TV, play a lot of old phonograph records. Sometimes I'd read a book, nothing very heavy, just some condensed version in the Reader's Digest. And I just kind of let the world go by, you know. I just kind of an observer of life. I don't participate in it, I just observe it. And I know that I could do a hell of a lot better if I really wanted to, a lot better than you guys are doing, I'll tell you that. I just don't want to, that's all. You know, I suffer from a dual problem. A lot of people in AA suffer from dual problems. They have, you know, they're alcoholics and drug addicts, and they're alcoholics and overeaters. They're alcoholics and this, they're alcoholics and that. I'm an alcoholic and a procrastinator. I always figure if a thing's worth doing, it's worth waiting until tomorrow to even consider doing it. As a result, I postponed about 20 years of my life. Every time a decision came up that was to be made, I postponed it. And you know, if you postpone them long enough, somebody else will make the decision for you. And then you can gripe, bitch, about the decision. And that's the way I live my life. And, you know, AA has helped me get out of that, helped me make some decisions. It's helped me grow up. You know, years ago, when I first came into AA, they used to talk about it. A group of doctors made a survey and studied alcoholics, try to find out what we all had in common. You know, we're from all walks of life, all colors and creeds, and rich ones and poor ones and fat ones and skinny ones. We're all, you know, what do we all have in common? And these doctors found out that we're all emotionally immature. You know, we're children with old faces. Now, I certainly identify with that. And AA has helped me grow up and take responsibility for my life and not blame it on somebody else, you know. I started drinking when I was about 18 years old, I guess. I did a little behind the gym drinking before that, you know, when I was 13 or 14, but I hit the big time when I hit 18. I wanted to be a man. I was in a hurry to become a man, and a man can buy a drink over a bar without being asked how old he is. In California, you're supposed to be 21. I walked into this bar and ordered a drink, and I passed for 21. The guy didn't even ask me for any ID or anything. Immediately, I became a man. That's what I wanted to be, and that's what I was, by God. And sometimes people say they came to AA, and they walked into AA, they walked into that room, you know, and they just felt like they came home. That's not the way it was for me in AA. But I sure felt at home in that bar, I'll tell you that. I knew I belonged there. I could play the jukebox over in the corner just as good as the rest of the guys. In fact, I thought my selection of songs were a little better than most. And like old Norm Alpe used to say, I could sit at the bar and look myself in the mirror and get better looking after each drink. And I just went back every opportunity I had. From then on, I drank on a regular basis. From then on, alcohol was the focal point of my life. Everything I've ever learned, with the exception of work, I learned while drinking. I either drank before, during, or after, and generally it was all three. And I drank all the time. I met my wife in a bar. Where else do you meet girls? And we got married and moved into a little tract house out in West Covina, east of Los Angeles, and started making payments on that house. The payments had come due, and I couldn't come up with a payment. I used my money to drink with. And as payments had come due on the first of the month, I figured, well, I'll just skip the payment this month, and I'll double up next month. You know, next month would come along, and I had to make two payments. My God, how am I going to do that? You know, I'd stiff all my other creditors, and somehow I'd make the payment. You know, we almost lost that house several times. And I don't think I ever made a payment on that house that I didn't pay a late charge. And if anybody would have asked me, Hank, what is your problem? I would have said, money. Yeah. Money's my problem. You know, I don't know how I got involved in this work I do. It just doesn't pay enough. If only she would go to work and help out, you know. But no, it turned out she was pregnant. And she already had a baby by a previous marriage, and here comes number two now, and I didn't know what to do, you know. And I didn't start saving for that baby until about a week before it was due. I couldn't make, you know, I had to go to the beneficial finance company and borrow the money to pay for the hospital and medical expenses when that baby was born. And, you know, when my son turned 25 years old and I finally got sober in AA for a few years, I finally got beneficial paid off. You know, I'd almost get those guys paid off and something would happen. Crisis would hit me. You know, I always had a crisis in my life. And I'd get them almost paid off, then I'd have to go and reconsolidate my bills again, you know. And then I'd get home with that money. It was never enough. Besides, something would happen to part of the money on the way home. And I'd start paying bills, and it just wasn't enough. So I'd have to go to the Pacific Finance Company and borrow the rest. Sometimes I'd have a loan at the bank going, too, all three at the same time. At income tax time, that was okay. I could deduct all that interest from my, you know, off my income tax. You can't do that anymore. And but used to be able to do that. But I used to look at all that interest I was paying and all those payments I was making, and I used to wonder, what is it that you're buying? You're making all these payments. What are you buying? I could never figure it out. After I was sober for a couple of years, I realized what it was. I financed about 25 years of my drinking. Every time I took a drink, I paid an extra 10, 15 cents in interest to Beneficial Finance. Yeah. Thank God I don't have to do that anymore. And it was just a monotonous life that I led, and my wife, just to create a little excitement every once in a while, she'd kick me out of the house. I could never figure out why, you know. I didn't do anything. I didn't know why I was getting kicked out. After I got sober for a while, I finally figured it out. That was what was wrong. I never did anything. But I wound up in Hermosa Beach, California, in a little shack. It was a garage that they had made some living quarters. And I went down there and rented that after being divorced for the third time by my same wife. I told her, you know, you really want this divorce, you got it. Just, I won't contest it. You can have the house, you can have the furniture, you can have everything. All I want is my stack of 78 records. And you can have everything else, you know. And I moved to this little place, and the landlady said it's a half a block from the ocean. I said, man, that's great. I'll get up every morning at 6 o'clock, and I'll run 5 miles along the ocean edge. Then I'll dive in the ocean, and I'll body surf a few waves in. I'll really feel good to get ready to go to work. And as far as I know, the water was down there. I never really got around to checking it out for sure. Well, I only lived there 4 years, you know. But I thought that was great, you know, and I'd live there, and I wouldn't have to report to anybody, and I could just live the life I wanted to live. And the life it turned out that I lived was I'd wake up at 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm already an hour late to work. Oh, man. I'd get in that car, weave in and out of traffic. I had to get there. You see, I should have worked yesterday. I left all these papers all over my desk. I had papers in my desk drawer. Some of them were months old. They were too old to turn in. If I turned them in, I'd be fired for holding them so long. If I didn't turn them in, I was going to be fired. I knew it was going to happen today. I knew it. And I had that feeling of impending doom that they talk about here in AA. You know, I had never heard that expression until after I got sober, but that's what it was. I had that feeling of impending doom. I knew I was going to be fired. I'd get to the office, check everything out, and everything looked the same as when I left. And I'd go get a cup of coffee, go back to my desk, and shuffle papers and make excuses to my customers. And at a respectable time, I'd go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked, and I'd go over there for lunch. And they sold martinis over there. And I like martinis. And they sold double martinis during the lunch hour for $1. The regular martinis were 75 cents. But during the lunch hour, you could get a double for $1. So I figured, who ever heard of having one martini? You know, you're going to have at least two anyhow, so you might as well order the dollar one. You'll save 50 cents. God knows you need the money bad. And so I'd order the dollar one. And I'd get to sipping on it. And I'd kind of check my drink against the guy sitting next to me. He'd have a 75 center. And I'd say to myself, just who in the hell do they think they're kidding? This isn't a double. It's a little larger than a 75 center, that's all. If it were really a double, they'd be charging more money for it, you know. I've been around. I know these things, you know. They can't kid me. So I better have another one. Then I'd have another one. Then I'd have another one. Then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office and tell them, I forgot to tell you, I'm going on a lot of calls. Take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. I'd head towards the beach and stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find, whatever was on sale that day at Thrifty or Save on Drug, you know, whatever they were pushing that day. That's what I bought. And I'd get home about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon. And I'm kind of a neat drunk. I'd hang up my clothes real carefully so the creases fall properly. And I'd put my shirt away and my shoes and everything and put my pajamas on. And I'd sit on the edge of my bed, and I'd untap that cheap vodka. It'd be like 2:30 in the afternoon, and I'd take a big, big jolt out of it, you know, several swallows. And I'd say to myself, well, done it again today. You know, this cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why the hell don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any actions on anything. Then I'd put one of these old 78 records, you know, on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" And then I'd go in on my fantasy about starting tomorrow morning, it's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork for a couple hours. When that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, a whole new life is going to open up for me. I'm changing my way starting tomorrow morning. And I'm going to get... I can't do anything about that marriage, but at least I can get squared away financially. And... you know, starting tomorrow, I'm going to work for 365 days in a row. You know, I'm going to work every single day for a year. And, you know, a lot of people do stuff like that. I can devote 1 year out of my life. What the hell? That's no big thing. A lot of people do stuff like that. They take jobs in Saudi Arabia and work in the oil fields. And look what happens to those guys. But, you know, they go over there to recoup their finances, you know. And I don't have to leave town. I can do it right here. And starting tomorrow, I'm not even going to drink for a year starting tomorrow. I'm going to put a big red X on the calendar. And I'm going to go for 365 days in a row. God, what a terrific idea. Sometimes I surprise myself, you know, what a wonderful idea that is. I can do that, you know, that's the solution to my problem. And I don't know about you, but when I got the solution, I can project. And I project 365 days. And I know how good it's going to be then, you know. And so I start celebrating a job well done. And have a few drinks and just feel good about it, you know. And I look up at the clock, it's 10 minutes to 11. Can't be 10 minutes to 11. I just sat down here on the edge of this bed. You know. And then I'd call the operator and check. 10 minutes to 11. Geez, I can't believe that. And then I'd realize I was almost out of booze. So I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas, and I'd run 2 blocks to the liquor store. I had to get there before 11. That's when I first started jogging, about that time. I had to get there. I'd get there just as the guy was closing up, bottle of Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands right around where I lived. I wouldn't want anybody to think I was cheap right there in the neighborhood. You know. And I could stroll back to my shack with peace and contentment and security for the rest of the night. And I'd get back home and I'd have my dinner, cold hot dog out of the icebox. Have a few more drinks and start rehearsing the speech I was going to have to give. I knew I was going to be salesman of the year. Somewhere in there I'd pass out. I'd wake up the next morning, it'd be 10 o'clock. And I'm already an hour late to work. Oh, man. Get in that car, weave in and out. I had to get there. I should have worked yesterday. I left all these papers, you know, and I'd get to work, check everything out. Everything's the same as yesterday. I'd get a cup of coffee, go back to my desk and shuffle papers and make excuses, try to look interested, and make, you know, and at a respectable time, I'd go to lunch at the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. I'd go over there and make my big decision of the day, whether to have the dollar one or the 75 cent. Then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one. Then I'd call and tell them. I forgot to tell you, I'm going to a lot of calls, take messages. And I'd head towards the beach and get home about 2 or 2:30 and hang on my clothes and put my pajamas on and sit on the edge of the bed, untap that cheap vodka, take a big, big jolt out of it, you know, several swallows. And I'd say to myself, well, you've done it again today. This cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why the hell don't you do something about it? You just sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on it. Then I'd put one of those old records on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" And then I'd go into my fantasy. Starting tomorrow morning, it's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to get down that damn office by 7. I'll knock out paperwork for a couple hours. When that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, a whole new life is going to open up for me. I'm going to work 365 days in a row. I'm going to get squared away financially. I can't do anything about that marriage, but at least I can get squared away financially. You know? I'm not even going to drink starting tomorrow. I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. And I don't know how I kept that job, really. But I did. Because, you see, I worked for this big company. And they had put my name on one of their business cards. And that's who I was. You know, I drank my wife away, my kids away, my home away. I drank everything away. All I had left is my job. And they had my name was on one of their business cards. That's who I was. You know, if I didn't have that job, I was nothing. I knew it. And somehow I managed to hang on to that job. And a couple of years ago, I completed 25 years with that company, and I quit. Before they found me out. You know. But I managed to hang on to that job. And that's the kind of a life I live. My ex-wife called me that one night, said, "Come and get your drunken son, just like you are." Seems that he had turned 16, he was getting in trouble in school, nothing very major, a lot of nickel and dime stuff, but he had gone to a party and came home intoxicated, and that was the last straw. She had had it with the kid, you know, and she said, "Come and get him." He didn't want to come and live with me. I didn't want him to come and live with me. But she said, so we had to do it, right? But he used to spend a weekend with me. And he hated coming down. Because sometimes when I'm drinking, I tend to get overly sentimental. I used to just slobber all over him. Tell him how much I loved him. You know, all the trouble your mother and I have had through the years has nothing to do with you. We love you. I can still see that look in his eyes, you know. And he asked his mother one time after spending a weekend with him, he says, "You know, you've divorced him. Is there any kind of legal action I can take?" "I don't want to go back there," he said. But he had to come and live with me. But you know, that was the start of a beautiful relationship that we've got going right to this day. And we did well together. I don't know, we just had the right chemistry and we just did real good, you know. And I kind of cut down on my drinking a little bit and we did very well. And my ex-wife came down to see him one Sunday, see how he's doing. And we got to talking and one thing led to another. And we both admitted we were miserable people, but we seemed to be more miserable apart than we were together. "Well, why don't we try this thing one more time?" So we, you know, we got to talking. You know, all we had is each other. Our daughter had already split, and our son would be going into the service. And you know, why are we treating each other this way? You know, why are we doing this to each other? You know, why don't we try to have some, you know, respect for one another and treat each other decently instead of fighting all the time. So we decided that we'd sell that house and she would move in there too with us. And we could pay off a lot of bills with the sale of that house and we'd get a fresh start. And She said, I won't even fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you. And I should have been suspicious, but I wasn't. Little did I know that during that 2 or 3 year period we were apart, she had started drinking. She didn't drink before that, you know, but she had started drinking. And she had crossed that so-called invisible line into alcoholism immediately, you know. When she spoke in AA, she used to say that she was an alcoholic from the first drink. You know, some of us are. Some of us are alcoholics from the first drink. The first time we take a few drinks, we get arrested, we have automobile accidents, all kinds of bad things happen to us, and then we continue that for 20 years and finally quit, you know. And things really get bad, and we start drinking wine, you know. In my case, that's not the way it was with me. Booze was a social lubricant for me, you know. It enabled me to dance and romance and do all the things that normal people seem to be able to do without that stuff. You know, just give me a couple of drinks and I can be very social, you know. Keep drink coming every so often. I can go to any party and any kind of atmosphere and I can be very social. And then I come home and I drink a fifth, you know, after I get home. I'm kind of a home drinker. I drink heavy drinking at home, you know. But that's the way I drank. I can't tell you when I crossed that line into alcoholism. Booze was my friend. It was a social lubricant for me. And I don't know when I became allergic to it, you know. Now, I know when I became allergic to penicillin. I took penicillin several times. You know, over the years, several times. Last time I took penicillin, I wound up in the hospital for 8 days. I damn near died. The doctor says, you know, you shouldn't have taken that penicillin. And I said, what are you talking about? It's always worked before. You know, he says, well, it's not going to work anymore. You become allergic to it. He said, I'm telling you, don't ever take penicillin again. You might die the next time. And I said, no kidding. I said, I promise. And I'm proud to stand up here tonight and inform you people that I've got about 32 and a half years off of that stuff. You know, I haven't had to go to one meeting about it. I haven't had to get a sponsor. I don't even know if they got Penicillin Anonymous or not. They probably do. They got every other kind of an anonymous. But I haven't, you know, it hadn't been necessary for me to call anybody up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and say I've got this uncontrollable desire to take a shot of penicillin. I just quit cold turkey. That's it. And it turns out the allergy to alcohol is a little different than the allergy to penicillin. I just never, ever have had a craving for a shot of penicillin. So I don't know when I became allergic to it, but I sure did, I know that. When she moved in, why, things right off the bat were bad, because she was not a fun drinker. She was just not a fun person to be around when she drank. She was a very outgoing, friendly person when she didn't drink. You give her one drink and all the pent-up emotions and hostilities of a lifetime would come out in that first drink as she was blacking out. And she had no capacity for the stuff at all, and she did all kinds of bad things while drinking. I hesitate to tell you, but I think I will anyhow. She did stuff like throw the Christmas tree, lights and all, out the back door. She used to break my old 78 records. Just because when I drink, I like music. And so I'd put one of those old records on. Same record, same song, same orchestras, everything. Same as when I was 18 when I went into the bar. I'm still playing those songs, by the way. And they got radio stations in Los Angeles that still play that music. But I'd put one of these old records on, turntable, and God, what a great song. I play it again. And I play it one more time. then again, and again, and again, and again. And he used to drive her crazy. Sometimes I'd get hung up on a trumpet toot. You know, I'd lay that needle in there, toot, oh man, that's really cool. Get the needle, put it in there again, toot, oh man. He used to drive her crazy. She'd walk over the phonograph, take the record, and smash. Don't break that. It's a priceless 78. You can't replace it. Good. I'll never have to hear that damn thing. One night she went over the phonograph and just took the arm and just bent it up. I couldn't play any more records that night, I'll tell you that. Next morning, I got up, I got a hammer and pliers and a wrench. I tried to straighten that arm out. I couldn't get it straightened out. With a metal arm. I don't know where she got her strength, how she could have possibly done that. And that's the way we lived. Only a lot worse. Yeah, a lot worse. And I finally told her, you know, that this is ridiculous. I don't know what we're doing together. You know, it's just worse than it ever was before. And now, you know, some people just should not drink. You're a bad drinker. You shouldn't be drinking. You know? And I said, you know, I allowed you to kick me out of those other houses, but I moved here first. Therefore, you go this time. And, I'm going to go to my brother's house tonight. And while I'm gone, I expect you to pack up and leave. When I come back tomorrow morning, I expect you to be out of here. And so I went to my good brother's house. You know, the brother that you can knock on his door at midnight or 1 a.m. And as long as you got something in a brown paper bag, he'll just pull you right in. We sat up all night and philosophized about the state of the world, you know, and women in particular. And while we were doing that, she decided to commit suicide. She was always committing suicide. Yeah. That was another one of her character defects. You know, she was always committing suicide. That was her solution back then. You know, if things don't go right, you just take a bunch of pills, that's all. And that's what she did several times. But I guess she always knew not to take that last one or something, you know. And that's one way of changing your environment, at least for a few days, anyhow. You kind of tiptoe around those people after they do stuff like that. But she was going to commit suicide that night, but before she did, she went into the closet where my clothes were hanging and just took a knife and slashed every stitch of clothes I owned. Just ripped everything to pieces, you know, cut my ties in half and my shirts and my coats and cut the pant legs off my pants. I think there's a few pants cutters in the crowd here. I don't know. And stabbed my damn shoes even. And for some reason, what really bothers me, she went in my dresser drawer and cut up my shorts. And then she went out in the other room and pulled the pictures off the wall and smashed them, the lamps, and pulled the drapes off the windows, and broke all the records, and just destroyed that little place we lived in. And then she turned the gas on the kitchen oven and went to bed. And she woke up the next morning. Nothing happened. You know. She looked around, and she saw what she had done. She had been the only one that had stayed there that night. She knew she had done it, but she didn't remember doing it. It really scared her. She just couldn't believe that she did that. And then I came home, and I had trouble believing it myself. And then our son came home, and he checked us out. He thought we were moving again. And we hit bottom. That was our bottom. Hit bottom. And I'm from a good family. She was from a good family. When we got married, we had wonderful plans what we were going to do with our life. You know, we were going to live the good life. And And all we had managed to do is just sit around and slowly drink every bit of goodness out of our lives. And from then on, nothing was good. From then on, it was all bad. I didn't quit drinking. I just kept on drinking, but it wasn't any good. It was no more fun times, ever. This wasn't doing it. And we had started back to group therapy a little bit before that. And the therapist asked me, "Do you really drink as much as she says?" I said, "Hell yeah, I do. I drink a lot. Who wouldn't marry to a woman like that?" I got, you know, two of the worst children you could possibly imagine. It's a pressure job. My God, the pressure on that job alone would make a person drink. So I need a few drinks in the evening after I get off work. You know, I just need something to calm myself down. I live a very stressful life. And so he said, "Have you ever thought of quitting?" I said, "As a matter of fact, I have." And I did. I used to think about it every night. You know, starting tomorrow, I'm not going to quit tonight, but starting tomorrow morning for a whole year, you know. And he said, "Have you ever thought of going to AA?" And I said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I've already been to AA." And I had gone to a meeting one time. It's one of these meetings where they give chips for various lengths of sobriety. I don't know if they do that here or not. But anyhow, that meeting there, that night, the guy said, "Has anyone just finished their first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get a chip." And he came up, this guy came up, "My name's Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really proud to get this chip. Yeah. I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And the lights in the eyes of the people, it just turned me on, keep me coming back to these meetings. And I just love every single person here." And just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my employer. He's made me general manager down at the plant. It's a wonderful, glorious way of life. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. And I thought, oh, man, you know, jeez. And anybody else? "My name's Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. The lights in the eyes of the people that turn me on, keep me coming back to these meetings. I just love every single person here. Hate is no longer a word in my vocabulary. I just love everybody. Not just the people in AA, but everybody in the whole world." A short time ago, my children, when they looked at me, they had fear in their eyes. Now when they look at me, they have respect. And I've noticed lately that my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. My children were failing miserably in school. And now we're getting letters from all the major universities throughout the United States offering free scholarships. It's a wonderful, glorious way of life that we have here. When I wake up in the morning, I reach over and I grab the hand of God, and we walk through the day hand in hand together. It's a wonderful way of life, and these 12 golden steps. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. And I, oh, jeez. I wasn't able to stay for the whole meeting that night. I needed a drink. And I needed it bad. And I went and got one, or 20. And so when this guy suggested AA, I said, "Forget it. You know, some kind of a spiritual program. You know, it's a religious sect of some kind, and it's okay with me. It's just nothing I'd be interested in." So he put me in touch with a doctor. I was going to get some antabuse because I was going to quit. And this doctor told me not to take antabuse. You know, he asked me, "How long has it been?" I was instructed not to take a drink for 2 days prior to that appointment. And he said, "Is it true you haven't had a drink for 48 hours prior to coming here?" And I said, "That's right." "You don't need antabuse," he said. "You're over the hump. You know, if you can go 48 hours without a drink," he says, "you don't need anything. You know, if you don't want to take it, if you don't want to drink, you never need to take another drink as long as you live. It's up to you. And then he went on and on and on about the disease of alcoholism. He said that people with the disease of alcoholism have character defects, and they absolutely refuse to work on their character defects. Instead of coping with their problem, they get drunk tonight instead. And they wake up the next morning, they still got all their problems, only now they got a hangover on top of it. And they keep repeating this over and over again. And he was telling me my story. I just didn't recognize it at the time. And he just went on and on and on about it. And I finally said, well, if you're not going to give me any Anabuse, doctor, I guess I better go. How much do I owe you? And he said, I can see I'm not making much of an impression on you, so I'm going to tell you something that I wouldn't normally tell my patients. But due to the nature of your appointment here today, I'm going to tell you something. I happen to know a little bit about alcoholism. You see, my wife's an alcoholic. We've tried everything for her. We've tried it all. We've tried rest homes and sanitariums, and we've tried drying out places, and psychiatry, and we've tried Anabuse. We've tried it all, treatment centers. They all work temporarily. They all work while you're in the sanitarium, you know. But after she gets out, she's drunk in a week or two. And she's never been able to stay sober until now. She's got 7 months without a drink. She goes to AA. And that's what I recommended you do. Skip all the hospitals and everything. Just don't go to, you know. And so I said, okay, you know. And I went home. Well, after this fiasco, my wife was so, you know, she was really, it really frightened her that she had done that. And she went back to that doctor. She had been with me and heard what the doctor had said. And she asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he said he didn't know. But why didn't she go to some meetings with his wife? His wife would be happy to take her. And that's why I'm standing here tonight. Because my wife went to AA. Because I'd have never gone back. And to be a good guy, I used to go to AA with her. Occasionally. Not all the time. Just occasionally. And I hated the meetings. You know, I absolutely refused to listen to anything that was said. I thought the people standing behind these podiums were paid lecturers, experts in their field. And I had a belly full of experts by then. You know what an expert is, don't you? An expert's a guy that knows 100 different ways of making love. Doesn't even. Girlfriend. You know, they're well educated people. They know everything about it. They absolutely know it. And they can give you all the answers. The only thing is, they don't know what a drink does for a guy like me. You know, they don't know that because they haven't experienced it. And they're well-meaning people. God bless them. You know, and I've had ministers, I've had doctors, I've had this therapist people try to get me to quit drinking, and they all meant well, but I didn't listen to any of them. And I refused to listen to them when I came to AA. I thought they were paid lecturers up here, and I wasn't listening to any of that crap. And somehow, just by sitting at the meetings, rubbing shoulders with a fellow alcoholic, somehow I got sober. And it's one drunk sharing with another drunk. That's what does it, in my case anyhow. And I got sober the same way Bill Wilson got sober. Bill Wilson was in and out of the hospital time after time. You know, and he'd be in there and he'd get out of the hospital and he'd go for a week or two or a month and he'd drink again. And he had a brother that was a doctor that tried to help him. Experts. And some guy knocked on his door one afternoon or one evening, I guess. a drinking buddy of his, and told him he didn't drink anymore. He hadn't had a drink for 60 days. It really got Bill Wilson's attention, I'll tell you. And it wasn't too much longer after that that he met Dr. Bob and they started AA. And that's the way I got sober too. One drunk sharing with another drunk. And thank God that meetings are here. You know, thank God that we can go to a meeting. Even if we know that we don't belong, even if we know we don't have the problem, at least we can come and listen, you know. These people used to come up to me and say, are you Lou's husband? I'd say, yeah, I'm Lou's husband. Well, are you an alcoholic too? I said, no, I'm not an alcoholic too. I'm a visitor. She's one. Work on her. Don't bother me. You know? And I'll be damned if I didn't get the message anyhow. And one day, I realized I had been sober for a couple of weeks. I can't tell you. You know, I was sober for 2 or 3 weeks. I hadn't had a drink. You know, and then anger set in. I just finished about 25 years of drinking. And I got this rotten wife and 2 of the worst children you could possibly imagine. And a pressure job. I owe money to everybody. It's all past due. I don't mean last week. I mean in the past. And they all want it right now. And now I can't even drink. What the hell am I gonna do? My life is over. You know, I've got this incurable disease. My life is over. I'm struck down in the prime of my life. I'll never be able to have any fun again as long as I live. I'll go to these meetings. I'll get up in the morning on time. I'll go to work on time. I'll eat my lunch on time. I'll come home and have dinner on time. Go to do a meeting on time. And I'll come home, go to bed at a reasonable time. And get up in the morning on time. Go to work. One long gray tunnel for the rest of my life. It's all over. They might as well dig a hole. I'll jump in it and they can cover me up. You can never go to a decent restaurant ever again. I'm stuck at Denny's for the rest of my life. What do they want to know when you go to a nice restaurant? Go to a nice restaurant, the first thing they want to know, would you like a cocktail for dinner? And you can't say to them, well, yeah, I'd like one, but you see, I've got this disease. It's of a twofold nature. It's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. If I take even one drink, I can't predict my behavior. If it wasn't for that, I'd sure have one. You know, I used to. I used to think you had to explain all that stuff to people. I used to spend about 90% of my day back then explaining things to people. If I was standing on a street corner and somebody walked up, I'd start explaining what I was doing. I had no self-worth at all. I had to explain this one little bit of space I was taking up in this world. You know, that's one of the things that I'm working on now. I'm trying to quit explaining. It's hard. It's hard not to explain. But I go for several days now without explaining. You know, I never get a full weekend, I don't think. But then I find myself explaining. I always start from the day I was born and bring you up to date, you know, all the pros and cons and ramifications of the subject. And I want you to understand my point of view. And then I realize what I'm doing, and I stop right in mid-explanation. They never, ever notice the difference. It turns out no one's listening to your explanation. No one's a damn bit interested in finding out why you haven't done something you were supposed to do in the first place. I'm just trying to quit altogether. I had 3 or 4 miserable months of sobriety. I hated being sober. I really did think my life was over. I didn't want to be here. I didn't want to be in AA. And they start talking about these steps, you know, taking step 3, turning your will and your life over and all that stuff. And I just couldn't relate to any of it. So I got a sponsor. You know, that's the best I could do. I couldn't, you know, I turned it over. Turned over to a sponsor. And he was a tough sponsor. You know, he is a tough sponsor. And you know, a tough sponsor will insist that you work the steps. And a tough sponsor will help you maintain your sobriety while you're working them. And that's what happened to me. And thank God for that. Because you see, it's the steps that sets us free. It's the steps that it's what a guy like me needs out there. I'm not talking about at the meeting. It's easy to be a good alcoholic at a meeting. Geez, all you got to do is hug and kiss the girls and shake hands with the guys. And hug some of them. You know? And so it's easy. But away from the meetings, you know, that's when you need the steps. Because you don't know what's going to happen to you. You know? And I joined this big group because he said, if you want me to be your sponsor, you got to go to a couple of these meetings that I go to. I want to see you. And I went to this group one Tuesday night. And format of that meeting was 2 10-minute speakers, and then they had a coffee break and a main speaker. And so this guy named Clint, probably some of you guys have heard him. He was the secretary of the meeting, and he said, Hank, you're the second 10-minute speaker tonight. I said, you're kidding, you know. And he said, no, I'm not kidding. You're the second 10-minute speaker. And I said, well, I'm new. I can't do that. And he said, doesn't matter, you know. He said, you just tell your story, it's 10 minutes, you know. And and I says, well, gee, I just couldn't possibly do that. He says, what are you saying? That you pass? That's it, I pass. I pass tonight, you know. Maybe some other time, that'd be fine, you know, but not tonight. And he said, we don't pass around here. We figured the way this group works is if you're asked to do something considered an AA request, and we don't turn down an AA request. And, jeez, you know. And so he said, but, you know, if it's really bothering you, you don't have to do it. You don't have to unless you want to, you know. But he says, I'll tell you something. And he was real nice about it. He wasn't smart-assy about it. He said, but I'll tell you what you ought to do. You ought to find yourself another meeting. A meeting where you can sit and be a spectator. He said, here in this group, there aren't any spectators. We all participate when we're asked. You know, I have found that to be true. I've gone to a lot of meetings over the years. And there's a lot of spectators in AA. And I'm glad I'm not one of them. I would have been, but that would have been my choice. But I said, oh, all right, I'll speak. Jeez, I'll make a big deal out of this thing, you know. And so I was the second 10-minute speaker. And, you know, you're supposed to say what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. I just stayed with what it used to be like, you know. And I exposed myself for what I was, a drunk, an alcoholic that owed a lot of money and wasn't very responsible and all that, you know, for 10 minutes. And then I had to quit. And then he had a coffee break. And you know, something happened to me that night that I hope happens to every single person in this room. I know it's happened to a lot of people here. I know that it has. But during that coffee break, I got just unconditional acceptance from about 200 people. You know, Jesus, what a, you know. I wasn't putting anybody on. I just told what I was like. I told the truth about myself. You know, the bad, you know, I wasn't putting myself in a good light at all, you know. And yet they accepted me unconditionally. I had this feeling of an unconditional love. It's a marvelous feeling, I'll tell you. Just talk about high. My God, I really got high after that. It took me a long time to come down. And I hope, you know, it's happened to me quite a few times since then. And I hope it happens to everybody in this room. Because that's what we get here in AA. If we work the steps, if we're willing to participate. Because, you know, just because we don't drink, it doesn't mean we really are happy people. I've seen some miserable people with a lot of time. And we have to get into action. I'm not a very spiritual guy. And I sometimes hear people talk about all the prayers that they make. And all the meditation they do. And that's okay. I'm not putting it down. It just doesn't really work very well for me. I love the third step prayer and seventh step prayer, and I especially like the 11 step prayers as it's presented in the 12 and 12, the prayer of St. Francis. And I love those prayers, but I can't, without action, they're just nice words. And I've tried meditating in the morning. And I've read a lot of spiritual stuff and everything, and it doesn't do it for me. So what I've got to do is, when I wake up in the morning, the extent of my meditation is, what's next? And if I can go through the day doing what's next all day, and not postpone anything until tomorrow, if I get through the whole day without postponing anything, and I go to a meeting, and I come home, and I lay my head on that pillow, I have a spiritual feeling. And I can't exactly explain it, but action is the magic word. You know, I don't care how many words you know. In my case, I could read the Bible, the whole Bible, every morning, and I still wouldn't get anything spiritual out of it. But going out doing what's next all day, I feel spiritual. So that's the way I work my program. And I got to quit here pretty darn quick. I'll keep postponing that too. But I got to tell you, my wife got sick with cancer and died here 4 years ago. And, you know, when she told me, she came to my office and told me she had cancer. I'm going to die in 3 months, she said. And, you know, here it is again, you know. And I'm afraid I didn't accept that too well when she told me that. Not that I wasn't sorry for her, but I was more sorry for myself. You know, that's kind of hard to admit, but I just felt how inconvenient it is now. Here we made all these plans. We had moved up to the desert. We had a home up there. We were going to retire up there. Now she's sick. It's going to ruin the whole thing. Yeah. And that wasn't a very nice way of thinking, but that's the truth. That's how I felt. I went to my meeting that night, because that's what I've been taught to do also. You go to your meeting regardless of how you feel. You feel good, you go to your meeting. You feel bad, you go to your meeting. Doesn't matter. You just go to your meeting if it's meeting night. Like a guy, Don, from Fargo, North Dakota. He says the only time you don't go to your regular meeting is when there's a death in the family. Yours. And he's got 42 years of sobriety, and I believe what that guy said. But I went to my regular meeting that night. And I didn't get anything out of the meeting particularly, you know, just a little meeting, sat around and discussed things. But at the end of the meeting, they read on page 164, it's in the chapter Vision for You. And you know, it's the last page on a page 164, and part of that says, ask in your morning meditation, what you can do for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. You know, I used to think, have I really worked these steps? I say I've worked them, but have I really worked them? You know. And when I have heard that read hundreds of times, and I've read it hundreds of times, but that night, that had a big impact on me. And I said to myself, yeah, my house is in order. My house is in order. Slowly, over a period of years, I had paid those guys off. You know, I had become dependable. I had become responsible. I was current in all my affairs. My wife and I had talked, everything that needed to be said had long been said. And we were current in our affairs. Our house was in order. My kids, who I wasn't even speaking to, or rather, they weren't speaking to me 20 years ago. We were on good terms. Our house was in order. And when I left that meeting that night, I knew I was going to be able to be of some help to her. That meeting turned my whole thinking around. And I was able to be of some help to her. And she didn't last 3 months, she lasted 5 years. And she died 4 years ago. And it was a shame that she had to go. And sometimes you wonder, you know, what it all means. How come she... You know, I smoked twice as, you know, 10 times as many cigarettes as she ever thought of smoking. I drank 20 times more booze than she ever drank. Yet she was the one that got sick and died. How do you figure that stuff? You know, you can't. You can't figure it out. Go nuts trying to figure that out. You know. But all I know is I just have to accept life on life's terms. I don't know. I don't need to know what it all means. I just need to experience life, that's all. And I do that. And I'm doing all right. My son used to look at me real funny back in those days, way back then. No wonder. He was stoned out of his gourd. And I'll be damned if he didn't turn himself into AA when he was 21 years old. And on May the 27th, I drove up to Santa Barbara and helped him celebrate his 17th AA birthday. And my daughter had a baby when she was real young. And that kid is 23 years old now, he says. Can't be that old. I can't possibly have a grandson 23 years old, but that's what he says. So anyhow, I had the privilege of speaking at my home group here not till in February, and after I got through, he took a 5-year cake. I don't know if they do the cake bit here or not, but he had 5 years of sobriety. And my daughter-in-law, they both send you greetings from Al-Anon. And you know, they actually belong to Al-Anon. They're just not non-drinkers. Sometimes people say, you know, they're Al-Anons, and they're really not. You know, Al-Anon is an organization that people join. And they go to the meetings, and they work the steps. You know, that's Al-Anon, not just being a non-drinker. That's not Al-Anon. You know? And I respect Al-Anon. I know a lot of people in there. I suggest that if you, any of you out there, haven't been to an Al-Anon meeting, this weekend's your chance, because there's a couple of them going to be speaking, and I suggest you go to one. You know, sometimes at these meetings, at AA meetings, they describe alcoholics about how we're above intelligence. You know, we're just smarter than most people, you know. You never, ever hear that at an Al-Anon meeting. And I'm very, very grateful to be sober here tonight. And it's really an honor to come here and talk. And my friend Dick, and my friends, I should say, Dick and Peggy Martin. And I've seen them over the years, and I love those guys. And I just love coming here and being with my friend Bud and Mary and Hugh. And nice to see everybody. My sobriety is the most precious thing that I have. I love being sober. Love being sober. I love the fact that I don't ever have to drink again unless I choose to. And I'm living with unsolved problems. I don't have to drink, even though I've got unsolved problems. So about all I can tell you when it comes to any kind of a message is what I heard at the first meeting I ever went to. It turns out that this really is a spiritual program. And I know that I found God when I walked through the door. The lights in the eyes of the people that turn me on and keep me coming back. Thank you very much.